I'm Brian Lauritsen. Every evening this week at 6 o'clock, I'll be speaking with one of this year's Oscar-nominated composers. Tonight, I'm joined by composer Terrence Blanchard, whose sweeping score for the Spike Lee epic Da Five Bloods balances the grandiose with touching intimacy. The film tells the story of four Black American vets who return to Vietnam seeking the remains of their fallen squad leader and the gold fortune he helped them hide. Da Five Bloods marks Terrence Blanchard's 25th score for a Spike Lee film or documentary, and after Black Klansman in 2018, his second Oscar nomination.
That's never really been our focus. Our focus has just always been the projects and trying to do good work. I got to tell you, that has been the cool thing about working with Spike, man. When Barry and Spike and myself were nominated for an Oscar a couple of years ago, we were interviewed. They were asking us, what is it like? And you know what I kept thinking about was, I said, man, the one thing about working with those dudes is that they don't talk about marketing. They don't talk about none of the other stuff. All the conversations are geared behind telling the story and doing what's best for the film.
I imagine the relationship has evolved over the years, though. I mean, do you remember what it was like in the very beginning working with them and versus what it's like today? Or
it was terrifying back then for me because I was such a newcomer to the genre. Terminology and stuff was like an issue. You know, I would be sitting in the room and the guys would be talking on. I wouldn't have a clue as to what they were talking about. But now it's a different type of fear. The fear now is about not being a weak link. That's the one thing about being in post-production, man. When it comes to you, everybody's done their job. And on Spike's films, that means everybody's done a phenomenal job. So with the Five Bloods, man, as soon as I got it, I was looking at it. I went, oh my God, some of my favorite people in this film. And man, their performances were just like ridiculous. You know, I heard Thomas Newman talk about this, and I can really relate, man. He says, when you start a project, you just feel like you don't know what the hell you're doing. And then you realize, no, that's just anxiety and fear. When you relax and just go about doing your job the way you normally do it, then things start to unfold and things come to you. And you go, okay, I can do this. I know what this is. But in terms of evolution, we've just gained more tools. We've just gained more experience. We've just gone deeper and deeper into the realm of Spike's cinematic vision. He has great performances. He pulls great performances out of actors to the point where there's no need for me to push. There's no need for me to be behind. I just try to be right with it. You don't have to overdo it to make a point because he always has great people that he works with.
Tell me a little bit about the choice of using a large orchestra for this kind of score. Is that about the feel of the film, or what led to you wanting to use a big, I think it's a 90-piece orchestra, is that right?
About 96 pieces.
Wow, yeah.
A lot of that was Spike. One of the things he said, I'm going to send you the script. It's got to be big. It's got to be big like Malcolm X. And I said, okay. And when I saw it, I kept saying, yeah, orchestra for this is what's going to be needed, because Spike has a unique way of telling stories where he uses a lot of source material and on-screen music to tell a whole nother narrative. And he gives you the flavor, the smell of where you are. He sets the pace and the time of where you are through all of that. He wants everybody to experience it. He wants everybody to come to it and gain something from it. So let's get a large orchestra, because we want to pay homage to these guys for their dedication and that ultimate sacrifice for what they did for us. But B, we want to put the film on a whole nother level. And the thing that I love about Spike as a film director is that when he's shooting, he's conscious of his budget to save money for post-production. He's saying, no, we're going to need 96-piece orchestra, so we're going to need how many days we're going to record, so that's going to cost us this. So he's going to put that money aside from the budget to make sure that they don't dip into that so he can have what he needs to really tell the story the way he wants to tell it.
Yeah. I'm thinking of, I mean, even just the opening of the film where he's basically setting the premise of the film, and your music has to do a lot of work to help set that premise. Was that a moment that you, did you feel the weight of that moment as you're writing the score?
Oh, man. The first opening scene for me, at least for the score, that helicopter firefight that was an amazing thing to experience. That was one of those moments where you go, oh my God, okay. You know, that was an intimidating moment when I watched that scene, because I went, if I was probably scoring that film for somebody else, I would sit there, oh, okay, drums, brass. We're going to have some syncopation. They're going to be exploding things going off. I'm going to accent those and blah, 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 blah. That's not what Spike wants. Spike wants melodic themes. He wants a very heroic, almost operatic kind of approach to doing those scenes. But the thing is, you can't have full orchestrations going for 4 minutes straight. You have to break it up. And it's tough in that scene because the action doesn't stop. And it just keeps unfolding. The helicopter crashes in the island. There's just a lot going on. It took me a while to really plot out some of the material for that thing. I kept going back and forth like, okay, well, why is that? It's one of those things I tell my students. There's always something that bugs you when you're composing, and you have to pay attention to it. Don't fluff it off like, oh, you know, maybe I'm... No, pay attention to it. So that's what I would do.
I wanted to ask you about a couple of specific moments in the film. And the first, it comes early on, the death of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I'm curious if you felt a certain sense of weight writing music for a moment like that. I guess you were, what, 4 years old when he was killed. And I don't know if you remember anything specifically from that moment or if you were old enough to have conscious thoughts.
One of the things that I remember was my uncle running to the TV. We had a little black and white TV in the corner. And I just remember him running to the TV and my mom kind of screaming, my grandmom, and everybody was like really upset. And I didn't really get what was going on. But growing up and understanding the full weight of that, yeah, I felt a responsibility to that scene, because it wasn't just about Martin Luther King being killed. It's about these African-Americans who we see who fought for the protection of this country, who gave the ultimate sacrifice over there. And while you're over there, somebody who was fighting for your rights was killed in this country. The irony of that was not lost on me when writing the music for that scene. And the anger and frustration that you saw in that scene was something really real for a lot of people. It reminded me of a moment where you're trying to hold back an emotional outburst, when you're trying not to cry, when you're trying to hold it together. But then all of a sudden that the floodgates just start to open. And that's what I thought the arrangement should do as well. As a composer, man, you look at that and you go, man, I'm just writing music. And as a musician, I just play the trumpet. You know, I wasn't out there fighting for our freedom. So the least I could do is write a piece of music, man, that honors their sacrifice.
Music that somehow lives in a space of trauma and in a space of humor and everywhere in between. I mean, that's an incredible feat here that you've achieved in this score.
No, thank you. Thank you. The thing about it, again, with Spike's films is that he makes it easy, because there's so many great performances in the film. You know, that whole scene where they find the gold is one of my favorites, just because of the up and down nature emotionally of that entire exchange. These guys are at each other's throats, and all of a sudden the prospect of finding that gold changed the entire energy and the reactions between them. But that's always what happens in Spike's films. You know, he'll take you on an emotional ride. The letter at the end, man, I thought was so powerful, because, you know, you tend to forget that Paul is a human being. For a good portion of the film, you just want to slap him upside the head. Man, what's your problem? And then there's that scene with the letter, and then the scene with him and Chadwick at the end. And those two scenes just like, it brings you full circle to realize this is what war has done to this man. Going through Martin Luther King being killed, fighting for a country that doesn't love you the way you're fighting for this country, that's what it did to him. And it was brilliant to wait and save that for that moment in the film. That's why I'm always feeling blessed to have my relationship with Spike, because I think he's brilliant in how he tells stories.
This film was released in June of 2020 at a time when there was this really important, intense conversation about race in the United States. Can you reflect maybe a little bit on just how this film comments on where we are as a society in 2020 and 2021?
Spike has always had a knack for putting things into context. Black Klansman, you go on that ride and you think it's a period piece, and then you get to the end and you see that montage of current events and you go, wow, it kind of puts things in perspective. And the same thing happens with this film. And there's so many things about this film. And not only that, but also Chadwick passing and understanding that here was a brilliant, brilliant, young, shining light who did his job brilliantly. You know, I've been trying to commit myself to creating stuff that helps to heal souls and helps to open up some hearts and minds. And with a film like The Five Bloods, man, it's a great opportunity for exactly that because of everything that goes on. But you got to hang with the film. You got to go from beginning to end to watch these characters develop and see their journeys, man, to really get it and understand it.
You're set for a big debut at the Metropolitan Opera later this year. All things, hopefully, you know, fingers crossed. But here is America's largest opera company, 138 years in the business. They've never performed an opera by a Black composer. They've performed 300 plus operas over the course of their history. And you'll be the first Black composer on their stage. What does that mean to you in the context of, like, certainly it's great to be a pioneer, but also it's been 138 years.
I'm honored for that, and I'm doing everything that I can to make sure that this is going to be something that people can be proud of. But it's time for us to open up those doors. There's a lot of other people that have stories to tell. There's women that have stories to tell. There's people from other backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, that have stories to tell. And that's the cool thing about opera. When we did my opera Champion here in New Orleans, there was an elderly gentleman, African-American gentleman, who came up to me afterwards and he said, man, if this is opera, I will come. And it made me realize, yeah, because the story is something he could relate to. He remembered Emil Griffith. He remembered the 1965 fight. And that's exactly what Puccini and all of those guys were doing when they created that story. So I think hopefully this will open up the doors for some other productions to be made that can really, really take advantage of the technology that we have in terms of getting the word out, but also hit the heartstrings of people who need to be entertained. We need to go to them and not constantly have them ask them to come to us.
The stats are almost ridiculous at this point. I appreciate that you mentioned, you know, women at the Metropolitan Opera. There have been two. Non-white composers, there has been one. At what point do you feel it shouldn't have to be my responsibility to say something, but here I am in this moment and I have some power and responsibility and platform? It's really complicated, isn't it?
It's a shame because I think other people have so much more to offer and bring to the table. And let me just say this, and then I'll let it go. You know, when you teach film scoring, one of the things that always fascinates me, and Sundance Film Labs, they have a program where they bring in six directors and six composers and they pair them up. But then there's another part of the tutelage where they get all six composers to score the same scene. And to me, that's one of my favorite things to experience because it's not like any of the kids come there with something that's wrong. It's just different. And I'm sitting there going, exactly. That's the way it's supposed to be. You know what I mean? There's not one way to do this. And to think that somebody else could come up with something totally different from my viewpoint excites me. It doesn't intimidate me. Because I want to know, man, how'd you come up with that? What were you thinking? You know, that I'm the nerd like that. It gets my brain working. And I think as a country, that's the approach we need to have when we're dealing with each other. Not coming to each other going, I don't know about that. No, that's the wrong thing to do. We should be more inquisitive than we actually are. We went through that when I was nominated the first time for an Oscar. We were on this panel discussion. I remember Hans Zimmer was there, but it was Hans, man. Hans jumped up. He said, well, what's missing here? He said, we got two African-Americans, but what's missing here? Women. And it's obvious. That's the thing. It's not a secret. It's the crazy part. It's not a secret. It's obvious. And listen, I get the idea of these multi-million dollar productions being something that people are fearful of just handing over to somebody that they don't know. We need to have, like in baseball, you know, we need to have a tier system where people could go out and get some experience doing these things and then come in and enter this world and broaden the scope of what it is that we do.
Yeah. Is it getting better? in the film industry, or?
I think so. When I was nominated the first time out, they have the Oscar luncheon. It was beautiful, man. The first name they called was Spikes. When they want us to take that picture, when we all get up on the podium, they called Spike's name first, and then they didn't call another name for a while. They just let him have a standing ovation while he was there. And then I wound up standing next to Regina King, and I was just looking around at all of the different types of people from different backgrounds, different genders. And I went, I think this is probably the most diverse class that we've had at the Oscars. And I think the same thing is happening this time. Listen, man, we're moving forward. So we just got to keep going and keep moving ahead.
Coming back to the film, there's a scene where Spike uses the Wagner Ride of the Valkyries. I'm assuming that nod to Apocalypse Now.
It's a war movie, man. Come on. It's got to be that somewhere. You know what I mean? Yeah. Okay.
Was there any classical music that inspired you growing up?
Of course. That's the reason why I'm doing opera. My father was an amateur baritone and wanted to be an opera singer. So he loved opera, and I heard opera in the house all the time growing up. My mom's sister, my aunt, she's a classically trained pianist. That music has always been in my life. But when I was a kid, in terms of classical music, they were really into the classics. And then I started learning more about Bartok and all these other different types of composers. And that really piqued my curiosity. I remember as a kid, I used to have the Bartok String Quartet's score. And I just used to listen to it all the time and go through it and study it, not knowing why. I mean, I was just curious about it. I was like, damn, how did he do this? And then, of course, any film composer is going to say The Rite of Spring. I think Stravinsky is going, can y'all just leave me alone for a second? I'm trying to rest in peace. Classical music has played a big role in my life. I used to play in civic orchestras when I was a kid, learning the trumpet. I was dealing with that literature also as a kid. It's always been there. I just never thought that it would grow into this. I didn't see this coming at all.
96-piece orchestra.
I'd never forget the first time I wrote something for Spike, which was for a scene in Mo Better Blues. I came and handed the music to his dad, and his dad said, no, you wrote it, you conduct it. I said, excuse me?
Did you have to buy a baton?
You know what, man? I still don't use a baton to this day. I always use a pencil, and it's just a psychological thing for me because I'm not a trained conductor. I mean, I'm getting better with my skills, but I'm not a trained conductor. And luckily, when I went to the arts high school, we used to do these sight singing classes where you would just learn these rhythms and do this, you know, and they would make us conduct. When we would sing those rhythms, that's exactly what I drew upon on that day when Spike's dad said, you wrote it, you conducted. I said, okay, one is here, two is here. I think I can do this.
Finally, the experience of watching this film, knowing that Chadwick is no longer with us, and just such a tragedy, and it took us all by surprise. There was something really surreal about watching the film, and also, in a way, it was just a really wonderful tribute to him as an artist, to his acting.
The scene at the end between him and Delroy, I can't tell you, working on it, I cried just because of the performances and where it was in the story and what it meant to the story. Watching it after the film was released and we learned about Chad, there's a certain type of numbness that comes over you because you don't know how to react, because it's that reality of life where you really want things to be different. You really wish something could have been done to save this guy's life because he meant so much to so many people. I remember right after he did Black Panther, man, his celebrity didn't seem to go to his head and he got it. I remember him surprising some people, fans and stuff. He would just come out, and it meant a lot to people in the African-American community to have an action hero like that. And he got that. He understood it. So you just had so many high hopes for this guy in terms of what he could do to inspire that next generation, all the other little kids that still look up to him now. And that scene, he says, you got me good. You got me. Watching that thing, you know, it tears me up. He was having treatments while he was shooting. And it just makes you realize, what do I have to complain about? What should I be angry about? I have the fortune enough to work with some great people, very creative people. I have my family behind me who's all healthy and well. I'm working in an art form that's allowing me to do my thing. There's nothing for me to be angry or depressed or feeling sorry about, because this guy He showed us the way. He showed us the way without preaching. He just did it. You know, Art Blakey used to say that to us all the time too. Art Blakey used to say, he said, man, stop preaching to people. He said, just live your life. Just live your life. He said, your life will be the example. And Chadwick exemplified that. It's a serious honor to be nominated, especially for something like that. But hey, I feel blessed just to have worked with some phenomenal talent. And I feel very lucky to have the career that I have. And I'm not taking it for granted. That's why I work hard at it.
Composer Terrence Blanchard has earned his second Oscar nomination for his score for the film Defy Bloods, directed by Spike Lee, his 25th collaboration with the director. When it opens the Metropolitan Opera's 2021-22 season this fall, Blanchard's opera, Fire Shut Up in My Bones, will become the first opera by a black composer to be performed in the 138-year history of the Met.